Accession number 32716, reel 2.
Year-round gale force winds and dense fog created the worst kind of flying conditions. Navy airmen remember it well.
It's cold, it's always foggy, it's always damp and everything.
We seem cut off from all the rest of it. Everything else was down south in the warm Pacific, you know, and here we are freezing ourselves up there.
From the Battle of Midway to the U.S. offensive at Guadalcanal, the war was raging in the South Pacific, led by General Douglas MacArthur. In the cold north, the airmen of Attu felt cut out of the action, but not for long. American military strategists were hatching a brilliant plan to trick the Japanese into thinking that Tokyo was about to be invaded, not from the south, but from the north. The airmen of Attu started bombing raids on the basically uninhabited islands of Shumshu and Paramashir, at the tip of Japan's Kuril Islands.
It was an ingenious part of the American plans to do bombing campaigns of the Kuril Islands. The idea was to keep the Japanese off guard, to do these flights, to do these bombings, to make them paranoid that there was going to be this massive frontal attack coming from the Aleutian Islands.
It caused the Japanese to move squadrons and naval forces to the northern Kurils to protect against an attack or a potential attack by the United States from the north. And in that process, the General MacArthur's forces that were coming up from the south had less Japanese resistance to deal with. And it's as simple as that, but it was very important, and it was carried out by such a small force, a small unit in terms of the aircraft involved, but the contribution was immense, and the story hasn't been told.
Bomber 31, like the rest of the squadron that took off that night, was a PV-1 Ventura, originally designed as a precision bomber. It was a resilient airplane, as Navy radio man Rudolph Tony recalls.
Oh, it was a rugged plane. There was no way you could tear it up, I don't think, if you tried. And we tried.
That's what I mean.
Attu was 750 miles from Shumshu, which is just south of the Russian peninsula of Kamchatka and its capital city, Petropavlovsk. It was one of the longest overwater bombing missions of the war. And danger was everywhere. If an aircraft ditched in the brutal Bering Sea, the chances of the crew's survival were virtually nil. And then, there was the ever-present threat of Japanese fighter planes to deal with. The PV-1 was fast enough to outrun Japanese fighters. Twin 2,000-horsepower Pratt & Whitney engines gave it a top speed of 322 miles per hour. Equipped with machine guns, these heavy bombers could also be transformed into fighter planes if the crew met up with enemy fire. Did Bomber 31 ever reach the Kuril Islands? Or did it encounter Japanese gunfire? Did it drop into the Bering Sea? Or crash land in some remote location? The fate of Bomber 31 and its crew would remain a mystery for more than half a century. Until one day in 1999, when this plane wreck was accidentally discovered by a Russian historian working in Kamchatka. The plane lies in ruin today on the steep slope of a volcano. And for most of the year, it's covered in snow and ice. Could this be the long-lost Bomber 31? That's what Ralph Wetterhahn wants to find out. A former Vietnam veteran and military crash investigator,
He has come here to unravel the mystery of Bomber 31. Familiar with World War II aircraft, Wetterhahn first wants to identify what type of plane this is. The gun turret tells him what he needs to know. This is indeed a PV-1.
Now here we have the top gun turret on the PV-1, and you can see it here. The plexiglass is gone, and the two 50 caliber machine guns have been removed.
Wetterhahn looks around for the section of the fuselage that might indicate which PV-1 this was.
Okay, this is the stabilizer. We can see
below the bureau numbers at the bottom of the stabilizer, the number 31. Lost to America for more than half a century, Bomber 31 has finally been found. In the airframe, Wetterhahn spies a small reminder of the men who flew in this plane.
What appears to be a Jefferson nickel.
A U.S. coin, frozen in time.
And it reads 1943. So there's no doubt in my mind that this belonged to one of the crew members.
But what happened to the crew members? There are no bodies near the wreckage. No skeletal remains are evident. Finding out what happened to the crew is as vital today as it was 55 years ago for the families left behind.
That's terrific. Sam's not much different than that.
For Kate Imperial, the wounds of World War II have never healed. Her brother, Sam Crown, was the radio man on Bomber 31. She vividly remembers that sad day in March of 1944.
I was making cookies to send Sammy when we got the word, when Mother got the telegram. Sammy was missing in action.
Was he 2 years younger than you?
About 2.5.
Okay.
Sam's son, Tom Raines, was only a 10-month-old baby when his father's plane disappeared.
Tommy, here's the, I believe, the last letter that Mother received from Sammy before he was missing in action.
And I see in reading this, he's talking about reunion and that he was confident that both Grandma and he and you would be reunited very soon. I want you to know that I carried a copy of this around with me in my wallet until it fell apart. I bet I had it 25 or 30 years until it just disintegrated.
For Tom Raines, the discovery of his father's plane has stirred up some strong emotions.
Yeah, you know, I always thought that there was always that possibility that one day someone would knock at the door and it'd be a father that had been missing for, you know, 15, 20 years, whatever it might have been.
Tom wants to see for himself the place where his father disappeared. He and his wife Kathy will soon travel more than 9,000 miles from Ohio to Kamchatka. It will not be an easy trip. He also hopes that some remains of his father's body will be found, so he can receive a burial in Arlington Cemetery with full military honors.
We need a pack mule to get us there.
The United States is unique among governments, spending $100 million a year to bring home the remains of its missing servicemen from around the world. Also en route to Kamchatka is a 10-person Army recovery team, led by forensic anthropologist Ann Bunch. Her job is to search for any remains of the crew that can be found and take them back to the United States for identification.
I've done 15 recovery missions. I had a good friend whose father was missing in action in Vietnam, so I think about her every time I'm out on a mission like this, because I know how she felt about her father and what it meant to her when we actually did recover and identify his remains. So I get motivated by that, because I know it matters to people.
8 hours after leaving Hawaii, the recovery team arrives in Petropavlovsk, the closest city to the crash site in Kamchatka. It's a fairly modern Russian city, but just on the outskirts, the terrain becomes rough and inaccessible. In this land of volcanoes, there are few roads, so the team had to switch to helicopter transport. Four weeks of camping and work supplies required many trips. After the campsite is set up, they still have an arduous climb over the shoulder of the volcano to get to the crash site. Getting here is only half the battle. Kamchatka is a perilous place. It has one of the densest populations of brown bears in the world. The recovery team also hired a half dozen local hunters to keep a 24-hour vigil for bears. And politically, Kamchatka was once considered one of the most dangerous places on Earth. During the Cold War, an ultra-secret Soviet military base was located here. This area opened to foreigners only a decade ago. This is the first recovery mission of its kind permitted in Russia. At first sight, Anne Bunch and her crew are dismayed by the state of the wreckage. Why is this plane such a mangled wreck? Why can't they see any human remains nearby? It's a mystery dating back to the days of the Cold War. The American recovery team heard rumors in Petropavlovsk that the wreck of Bomber 31 had first been sighted in 1962 by Russian geologist Mikhail Khotin. He remembers a largely intact plane and several human skeletons.
There were four people lying around the plane. Someone would yell, "Here's another man. There is another man over there." They were showing above the ground.
Two of the dead men were wearing wedding rings.
When I saw that there was a name inscribed in one ring, my first impulse was to contact the family. I thought I should let them know that he was dead.
But the families were never notified, and the rings never returned. In fact, no one was told, except the KGB. Colonel Konstantin Golombovsky from the Russian Air Force has tried to get to the bottom of the Soviet side of the story.
Everything was handed over to the KGB along with a report on the aircraft. Where did all those things end up after that? We couldn't find any traces of them. There are no documents.
The more questions we asked, the more stern looks we got. They made sure we forgot.
Colonel Golombovsky also learned that the Soviet military was called to the crash site.
According to the geologist's report, there were unexploded bombs lying near the aircraft. So, in order to prevent any fatalities, a military team detonated all the ammunition that hadn't exploded.
But the state of the wreckage suggests the KGB went further than they needed to make the area safe.
When the KGB came up in the 1960s, they cut the airplane into sections and moved things around, probably to disguise the plane from U.S. spy satellites. Now, that's conjecture, but we do know they were up here. We do know they blew. You can see this crater here? This is more than likely one of the areas where they blew up a 500-pound bomb. So you can tell that probably this wreckage was maybe 30 or 40 yards further up the hill at some point.
A safety sweep of the entire site is required before the recovery team can start looking for human remains. And they find just what they were afraid of, an unexploded 500-pound bomb. The area is roped off because the bomb is still potentially dangerous.
The fuse is still intact.
But this bomb is also an important clue. If Bomber 31 still had ordnance aboard, it's unlikely the crew were able to drop their bomb load. But why? Did they meet up with enemy fire before reaching their target? And will the clues found here solve the mystery of what happened to the seven crew members?
I think that the idea that seven are here, you know, given the intelligence reports, I have my doubts. So I'm already biased, but I'm not going to stop looking for them until we feel that we've excavated the whole site thoroughly.
Finding human remains in a field filled with rusting relics from a war-long past is like looking for a needle in a haystack. But today, even tiny bone fragments can help identify the crew.
During World War II, bodies were identified by people looking at the teeth, trying to get dental records, or finding the dog tag of a dead soldier. Very hard. But now we have DNA, and things have improved immensely. Even a fragment of a remain can open up through DNA a whole window of clues of who that person is. So it's a very exciting time in the science world to close for the Defense Department a lot of these cases that have been open for 50 years.
Like the case of John Hanlon, the co-pilot on Bomber 31.
Okay, Mary, gonna draw some blood now.
Mary Porciello was John Hanlon's sister. Crucial parts of her genetic makeup are the same as her brother's. Mary's blood will be sent to Ann Bunch's lab. If they find any remains in Kamchatka, the DNA will be compared to see if it matches hers. Blood will be collected from living relatives of all the crew members of Bomber 31. The closer the relationship, the better the match. Mary hopes that DNA will finally provide the answer to a question that has haunted her for a lifetime.
Here we go. We'll put it in the box.
I think I dealt with the death a long time ago, but the finalization of what really happened to him is important now. They gave their lives for this country, and I think that's the least the country can do is finalize their death.
But no human remains have been found yet. After cutting away part of the plane, the recovery team scours the cockpit, hoping to find some evidence of pilot Walt Whitman or co-pilot John Hanlon. They only detect slivers of human bone. Now underneath the cockpit, Ann Bunch is looking at a parachute. It's an important clue. A parachute inside the plane suggests that at least some of the crew were still in the plane when it crashed. For weeks, they will sort through the rubble and sift through the dirt. No clue is too small in their effort to identify the seven airmen. Ralph Wetterhahn is finding more evidence that the plane must have encountered the enemy before reaching its bombing target.
On this particular engine, you can see battle damage under the prop spinner and there's a big hole and an explosion has occurred up in here. So we know it was hit with something, and it could be an aircraft fire from the ground, or it could be a Zero or a Zeke aircraft shooting at the bomber. The engines had some type of battle damage.
Here, Wetterhahn finds evidence that a projectile came through the exhaust stack and penetrated the area below, crippling the airplane. After a thorough examination of the wreckage, Wetterhahn has unraveled more of the mystery of Bomber 31. After leaving Attu in abominable weather, it's likely that Bomber 31 met up with Japanese fire just before reaching Shumshu. With critically damaged engines, the pilot turned toward Kamchatka, hoping to make the airport in Petropavlovsk, less than 100 miles away. But the weather was also against them.
He may have had fog down below in the valley he couldn't see, and he saw this flat area out in front of us here, and he brought it in and put it down very level. His last moments, his last full measure was some kind of fabulous flying to get that airplane in here.
But what happened to the crew? Did they all go down with the plane? Or did some of them try to parachute out and maybe get captured by the Japanese? A few days after Bomber 31 disappeared, rumors began flying among the men of the squadron about what might have happened. Some remember Tokyo Rose, the voice of Japanese propaganda, reporting on the incident.
Tokyo Rose had a story. She said that the pilot's body had washed up on this shore and everything, that they'd probably shot it down and everything.
Others reported that Tokyo Rose broadcast the name, rank, and serial number of every member of the crew, and even used John Hanlon's nickname, Moose. How could the Japanese have such information?
Three different people heard three different stories. One was that the bodies had been recovered, another was they had their flight jackets, and the third was that they had them prisoners. So, you know, there's always that possibility if his remains are not on the plane, then where was he? Did he bail out? What else could have happened to him?
There's no hard evidence that any crew member of Bomber 31 was captured by the Japanese. But Ralph Wetterhahn decides to fly over to Shumshu to see it for himself. The Kuril Islands became Russian territory in 1945, after the war was over. From the helicopter, he can see clear signs of American bombing not far from an abandoned Japanese airstrip.
That's pretty typical of what you'd see when an aircraft drops bombs out of a bomb bay. They're gonna string along, and this would be one area that they would want to hit.
The bombing raids of the Kuril Islands proved to be some of the toughest missions of World War II. Fearing an American invasion, these Japanese islands were heavily defended by air and anti-aircraft guns in bunkers and boats. This, combined with bad weather, took its toll on the U.S. airmen. Ralph Wetterhahn tries to imagine what a bombing mission from Attu to Shumshu might have been like.
They lived and flew out of an island that was simply a rock that was covered in fog and ice, climbing into weather that would test the most proficient navigator, the most proficient pilot, and having to do it through 750 miles over this cold, leaden Bering Sea.
We didn't have a very good, any navigation aids were, you know, reliable up there much, and there weren't any reliable maps. It was, you know, virgin territory.
They had to fly 5 hours in just bad weather until their 10 minutes of stark terror over the target area. So the gunner would have test-fired his weapons, and those little sounds would start coming through, and the heart rate's going to go up, and the adrenaline starts to pump. And as you get in close to the island, you start to see the flak come up, and then everybody's eyes are out looking for bogeys.
Oh,
you cool until you get out of the battle, and then just shake all you want to. As long as you're in battle, keep your cool. They know this is it. This is the 10 minutes where we either get it done or they get it done to us. And then turn around without fighter escort and get out of there in one piece and do the same thing all the way back. And a lot of them didn't. And they knew it taking off that, you know, there was a good chance they wouldn't come back.
On their return trip to Kamchatka, Ralph Wetterhahn and Pentagon investigator Jim McDougal encounter an incredible sight. It's the wreck of another World War II airplane. Wetterhahn and McDougal decide to investigate.
It had the big squadron number.
Yeah.
I'll tell you what, take a look at the list of PB-1s we had last year when we went up on Winoski.
Right.
PB-1. So we've confirmed that much. I mean, we thought that it was a PB-1, and that confirms that.
What do you got down here? Look.
Yeah, that looks like three zero.
This PB-1 belonged to a different squadron. It was forced down by anti-aircraft fire during a raid on August 20th, 1944. Miraculously, its crew escaped with only minor injuries, including radio man Rudolph Tony.
When we started walking down toward the beach, three Russian soldiers come with rifles. And Jack remembered that Russian was Amerikoski. And when he said Amerikoski, that Russian grabbed him and bear hugged him like he was a long lost brother.
Rudolph Tony's pilot deliberately crash-landed on Russian territory, knowing his crew would be safe. Russia allowed crippled American aircraft to land on its soil. Because the Soviet Union was not at war with Japan, the airmen would be officially imprisoned, but secretly returned to the United States. Not so lucky was the crew of Bomber 31, including radio man Sam Crown, father of Tom Raines. After crossing 15 time zones, Kathy and Tom Raines have finally reached Petropavlovsk. So close to the place where he lost his father, Tom's expectations intensify.
I certainly hope that things work out, that we're able to find some remains for my dad. I would be disappointed, but I'm certainly looking forward to this.
Now they have to get on a helicopter for the short trip to the crash site.
This is it. Long time coming.
These 45 miles will turn out to be the most difficult of their three-day journey. The flight gives Tom an idea of the harsh terrain his father's stricken bomber had to negotiate, especially during the winter with high winds and temperatures well below zero. But even in the summer, the weather is temperamental and can change by the hour, especially in the mountains. A heavy fog moves in, and the helicopter crew becomes lost. They land to get their bearings.
It seems pretty apparent that the pilot does not know exactly where to go. The coordinates we thought we had locked in, and it's still not working very well. It's very, very frustrating and very disappointing, too.